July 20th, 1986, St. Croix, U.S. Virgin Islands. 66-year-old Jim Rice phones his daughter to let her know that he will be traveling to California to have shoulder surgery the following week, but he never arrives and no one ever hears from him again. Jim's common-law wife, Astarte Davis Rice, initially claims that he took off to Australia with another woman, but evidence soon emerges that Astarte has committed fraud to seize control of Jim's estate. Astarte winds up serving prison time for these offenses, but while the authorities suspect that she killed Jim and disposed of his body, there is not enough evidence to file murder charges, and no trace of him is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we'll be covering a pair of cold cases from Unsolved Mysteries: the 1986 disappearance of Jim Rice and the 1984 murder of Mark Grossinger. One of the biggest tropes in true crime is the husband did it, because when a married woman is murdered or goes missing, a lot of the initial suspicion is directed towards her spouse. Well, on this particular episode, we're going to be reversing genders and exploring a pair of cases in which a victim's wife immediately came under suspicion, yet the authorities have never been able to gather enough conclusive evidence to prove they were responsible. The disappearance of Jim Rice marks the first time our podcast has ever covered a case which takes place in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Jim and his common-law wife, Astarte Davis Rice, had relocated to St. Croix after building their dream house there, but right before Jim was scheduled to travel to California in order to undergo shoulder surgery and visit his daughter, he wound up vanishing without a trace, and Astarte would not waste any time at attempting to seize control of his estate. Astarte's story is a pretty wild one, as she has committed numerous acts of fraud throughout her life and done multiple stints in prison. But even though she is suspected of being responsible for Jim's disappearance, his body has never been found, and there was no direct evidence of foul play, so Astarte has never been charged with murder. Now, our second featured story involves a man named Mark Grossinger, who was shot several times inside his parked car, and it wasn't long before his wife, Judy Grossinger, came under suspicion. The crime was believed to be financially motivated, as Mark had taken out a substantial life insurance policy on himself in the months prior to his death. But while there was a compelling circumstantial case that Judy was involved in her husband's murder, the authorities once again felt that the evidence was not strong enough to make an arrest. What complicates both these cases is that even with the cloud of suspicion surrounding Astarte and Judy, it is believed that they may have orchestrated a murder plot which involved multiple individuals, so it's unclear if either of these women were personally responsible for their husband's death or if they got someone else to do it. So on this episode, I'm going to start off by discussing Jim's disappearance, followed by Mark's murder, and then I'm going to share my theories and analysis about both these crimes. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the disappearance of Jim Rice. Our Our first story begins in 1986 on St. Croix, an island located in the Caribbean Sea, which is part of the United States Virgin Islands. Our first victim is 66-year-old James Merrills Rice, who goes by the name Jim, and lives on St. Croix with his 53-year-old common-law wife, Astarte Davis Rice. Originally born in Tacoma, Washington, Jim was a former college football player and decorated bomber pilot who served in World War II, before he moved to Contra Costa County, California, and started up a successful construction business, which allowed him to eventually amass a net worth of nearly $2 million. While Jim got married and had a daughter, he would become separated from his wife, but by 1970, he had developed an attraction to Astarte Davis, whom he employed as his bookkeeper. Originally born under the name Estrabel White, she had decided to change her name to Astarte, which happened to be the name for the Phoenician goddess of love and fertility. By this point, Astarte had already gone through 3 divorces and had a trio of sons with her third husband who were named Noble, Loyal, and Regal. By all accounts, Jim fell head over heels in love with Astarte and decided to marry her at a chapel during a trip to Reno, Nevada, but their marriage wasn't technically legal since Jim's divorce from his ex-wife had not yet gone through. Jim's daughter, Kathy Clements, would later say that she wasn't sure what her father saw in Astarte, but did acknowledge that she seemed to make him happy. All that being said, their relationship would sometimes be a turbulent one, as Jim and Astarte separated numerous times, though they always reconciled and got back together. In 1979, Jim and Astarte decided to move to Kona, Hawaii, where they purchased a 55-foot charter boat named the Blue Hawaii and started a charter fishing business. On January the 8th, 1981, Jim was out of town, but Astarte's 19-year-old son, Noble Davis, was in Kona visiting her and took the Blue Hawaii out into Honokahau Small Boat Harbor in order to use gasoline to clean the engine. At around 3:30 a.m., Noble said that he went out onto the deck to smoke a cigarette, but may have accidentally ignited the gasoline as the boat suddenly exploded and propelled him into the water. Noble wound up surviving the explosion, and even though he suffered a few burns, he was not seriously injured, as Astarte was on a nearby dock and was able to pull him out of the water and drive him to a hospital. The Blue Hawaii was completely engulfed in flames and sank to the bottom of the harbor, but the police instantly became suspicious of Noble's story, as they found it odd that he would be cleaning the engine at 3:30 a.m., and his mother just happened to be out on the dock at that hour. Other boat owners also told police that soap and water were ordinarily used to clean a boat's engine rather than gasoline. Well, it turned out that Jim and Astarte had recently been involved in a major legal dispute with the Blue Hawaii's former owner, Hope Nelson. Interestingly enough, Nelson had once been fishing partners with iconic Hollywood actor Lee Marvin, but years earlier, the two men had been involved in their own legal dispute over ownership of the boat. After this dispute was resolved, Nelson sold the Blue Hawaii to the Rices for $162,500, but claimed that after they made the initial $47,000 down payment, they never made any further payments. The matter went to court, and in December of 1980, a federal judge ruled that Jim and Astarte had to pay Nelson everything they owed plus interest, as well as a $7,700 judgment for breach of contract and $5,800 in attorney fees. The Rices said they intended to appeal the decision, but the Blue Hawaii exploded a few weeks later. The boat carried a substantial insurance policy, but given the suspicious nature of the explosion, the insurance company refused to pay it out. Even though Noble continued to insist that the explosion was accidental, the authorities came to the conclusion that it was a deliberate act of arson and that Astarte had orchestrated the whole thing. They eventually amassed enough evidence to charge Astarte and Noble with arson and insurance fraud, but since Jim had been out of town when the explosion occurred, it sounds like investigators believed he was not involved in the scam and had no idea it was going to happen. Astarte and Noble returned to California, but were never extradited back to Hawaii to stand trial on these charges. Jim also went back to California, but decided to separate from his wife over the incident. In August of 1982, Astarte found herself in more legal trouble for bankruptcy fraud. Earlier that year, Astarte had purchased over $20,000 worth of jewelry and furniture, but when her checks bounced, Astarte told her creditors that she was filing for bankruptcy and sent them copies of the forms she had filled out for it. But the problem was that Astarte had already filed for bankruptcy in May of 1981 and sent these creditors the original form she had filled out with the dates changed. The creditors discovered the ruse when they showed up in court for a bankruptcy hearing and discovered that the notice of the meeting had actually been for a date from the previous year's form. If that wasn't enough, when Astarte filed for bankruptcy in 1981, she falsely claimed that she only had $700 worth of assets and did not own a car or any property, but in actuality, she owned a $24,000 Jaguar and a $159,000 home under her birth name, Esther Bell White. In November of 1982, Astarte agreed to plead guilty to bankruptcy fraud and wound up receiving a 10-month sentence at the Federal Correctional Institution in Dublin, California. While Astarte was incarcerated, Jim agreed to visit her, and she managed to convince him that the situation had been a major wake-up call for her, so she promised to turn everything around and not perform any more illegal activities. Jim believed Astarte, and after she was released in 1983, Jim decided to retire, and the couple made a plan to move to St. Croix. They spent the next year building their dream house, which would be located on an isolated bluff overlooking the Caribbean Sea near the town of Christiansted. After the house was completed, Jim and Astarte permanently relocated to St. Croix, and things seemed to be going well for them. In 1986, Jim made plans to travel to San Francisco, California to undergo shoulder surgery in order to treat an old football injury. On July the 20th, Jim phoned his daughter Kathy and told her that he planned to leave St. Croix on the 28th and arrive in San Francisco on the 29th. He would then stay at Kathy's home during his recovery, but said that Astarte was not going to accompany him on the trip since she had already made plans. However, after their call ended, Kathy would never hear from her father again, as he did not show up at her house or call her from the airport on July the 29th. Jim also did not show up for his surgery, so for the next 2 weeks, Kathy kept calling her father's residence in St. Croix, but was unable to get hold of him. Her concern grew when she remembered a previous conversation with Jim, where he told her that he felt that something was going on with Astarte, but couldn't figure out what it was, so he instructed Kathy to come looking for him if he ever disappeared. Kathy finally managed to get a hold of Astarte on the phone, and she shared the surprising news that Jim had sailed off to Australia with another woman. When Kathy had another phone conversation with Astarte a few days later, she suddenly changed her story and now said that Jim had left on a flight from St. Croix to Miami. Astarte would later be questioned about this by the authorities, but denied that she ever told Kathy about Jim having left on trips to Australia or Miami. The authorities in St. Croix seemed reluctant to take action and perform an official missing persons investigation for Jim, so after 2 months of not hearing from him, Kathy decided to hire the services of a private investigator named Dennis Sherratt. Sherratt eventually obtained a customs declaration form, which had been signed by Jim at Miami International Airport on June the 28th, 1986, the same day he had been planning to leave on his trip to San Francisco. However, Sherratt became convinced that the signature on the form had been forged, so he notified the FBI about this, and they launched their own investigation. The FBI would soon discover that Jim had purchased a plane ticket from St. Croix to Miami on July the 28th, but came to believe he never actually boarded the flight. Instead, they were convinced that Noble had used the ticket under Jim's name and was accompanied on the flight by his mother and his girlfriend. Sherratt also discovered that on the morning of July the 21st, 1 day after Jim's final phone call with his daughter, Astarte had presented a number of documents to a notary, including one for power of attorney, which allowed her to take control over Jim's entire estate. Upon closer inspection, Sherratt noticed that Jim had originally drawn up this power of attorney document for Kathy on a previous occasion, but Astarte had performed a cut-and-paste job and inserted her own name over Kathy's. It also turned out that only a few days after Astarte filed these documents, she and Noble held a garage sale in which they sold off many of Jim's personal effects, including his tools and truck. Well, 4 months after he disappeared, Kathy received a typewritten letter from Sydney, Australia, which was signed Jim Rice. Of course, Astardian initially claimed that Jim sailed off to Australia, and in the letter, he wrote that he was having a great time there and doing a lot of fishing. Jim wrote that he elected not to make the trip to San Francisco because during his final conversation with Kathy, he felt by the tone of her voice that she did not want him to come there. Jim also apologized to Kathy for missing her birthday and promised to make it up to her. Of course, Kathy immediately suspected that her father did not actually send the letter, as his signature appeared to be forged. Throughout the course of the letter, the words I am were constantly misspelled as one single word rather than I and am being separate words. A check of other letters that Astarte had written in the past showed that writing I am as one single word was a grammatical mistake she frequently made, so Kathy became convinced that Astarte had typed up this so-called letter from her father in order to give off the false impression that he was still alive. Kathy reached the conclusion that Astarte likely murdered Jim and may have disposed of his body somewhere in the Caribbean Sea, but without any hard evidence of foul play, Astarte could not be charged with murder. Regardless, Kathy still had her father legally declared dead. In December of 1988, the government of the United States Virgin Islands indicted Astarte on 28 separate charges in relation to her attempts to illegally appropriate Jim's assets and defraud his estate. Some of her actions which led to these charges included forging property titles, attempting to steal $200,000 in certificates of deposits, and cashing forged checks. If that wasn't enough, the United States government also indicted Astarte on 5 federal charges of mail fraud. She was subsequently released on bail and sentenced to house arrest in St. Croix to await trial, but she failed to show up for her first scheduled court date in September of 1989 and became a wanted fugitive. During her time on the run, Astarte actually sent a letter to the Contra Costa Times newspaper to claim that she was only hiding because she was being framed for Jim's murder. Astarte managed to evade the authorities for over a year, but in January of 1991, a bookkeeper named Peggy Morris was arrested in Santa Barbara on suspicion of embezzling $10,000 from the construction firm where she was employed. It wasn't long before police performed a fingerprint check and discovered that Peggy Morris was actually Astarte living under an alias, so she was charged with additional felony counts and held without bail. Astarte's employer in Santa Barbara would later say that she once got drunk at a company party and started rambling on about a spot in the Virgin Islands which would be a good place to hide a body. In March of that year, Noble was tracked down and arrested as well, and he agreed to plead guilty to charges related to his involvement in Astarte's scam to seize Jim's estate, as well as an additional charge of attempting to corrupt a grand jury witness who was scheduled to testify against his mother. On April the 3rd, Unsolved Mysteries aired an episode containing a segment about this case. While Astarte was still in jail awaiting trial on the fraud charges, the show was hoping that someone might come forward with new information which led to the recovery of Jim's body or implicated Astarte in his death. There was also hope that Noble might agree to testify against Astarte about Jim's murder, but this never came to fruition. Astarte went on trial for the embezzlement charges from Santa Barbara and was found guilty and received a 3-year prison sentence. But before she could stand trial for all the charges related to Jim's estate, both sides reached a plea agreement in August. Astarte agreed to plead guilty to 8 of the charges, which included 3 federal charges from the U.S. and 5 charges from the Virgin Islands, in exchange for the other charges being dropped. Astarte would receive a 15-year sentence in federal prison, which would run concurrent with the 3-year sentence she had already received for the embezzlement. She served her first 5 years at a medium-security federal prison in California, but in November of 1997, arrangements were made to transfer her to the minimum-security federal correctional institution in Dublin, which did not have fences or security barriers. Well, sometime on the morning of August the 7th, 1998, Astarte seemingly just walked out of the facility. It was established that Astarte was present when the morning count took place between 5 and 6 a.m., but when a fire drill occurred around 4 hours later at 10 o'clock, Astarte was discovered to be missing. Since she had not been scheduled to work that morning, it was believed that Astarte escaped from the institution shortly after the first count. Since Astarte was now a wanted fugitive, she was profiled on America's Most Wanted, and in September of 2002, Unsolved Mysteries wound up airing an all-new updated version of their original segment, which mentioned Astarte's prison break and urged viewers to come forward if they had seen her. Well, it wasn't long before the show's telecenter received a tip that Astarte was now living in the South Hill neighborhood in Spokane, Washington. A few weeks later, on October the 3rd, the authorities spotted Astarte walking through the area and followed her home, where she was promptly arrested and taken into custody. Once again, Astarte had been working as a bookkeeper, this time under the assumed name June Thorne, but even though she had undergone plastic surgery to disguise her appearance and looked younger, a fingerprint check confirmed her identity. Astarte was subsequently convicted on escape charges and had an additional 2 years added to her original 15-year sentence. After she was returned to prison, Astarte served the remainder of her sentence before she was released and moved to Sacramento. I have been unable to find any confirmation if Astarte is still alive at this point, but if she is, she would currently be 91 years old. However, even though investigators consider Astarte to be the prime suspect in Jim Rice's disappearance, he is still technically a missing person, and no one has ever been charged with his murder. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So now let's move on to our next case. Our second story takes place in 1984 in Golden, Colorado, a town located in Jefferson County, which had a population of around 13,000 at that point, and is part of the Denver metropolitan area. Our central figure is 29-year-old Mark Grosinger, who lives in Golden with his 26-year-old wife, Judy Grosinger, and works as a concrete cutter. On the morning of April the 7th, a motorist came across a two-door 1973 Buick, which was parked near the entrance of the Mother Cabrini Shrine, which is dedicated to the first known American saint, Francis Xavier Cabrini. The shrine is located on Lookout Mountain, a foothill on the eastern flank of the Front Range of the Rocky Mountains, which has a clear view of downtown Denver and is just under 2 miles southwest from Golden. The motorist noticed that the Buick's driver's side window had been shattered, and when he pulled over for a closer look, he discovered Mark Grosinger's dead body sprawled across both of the front seats. Investigators from the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office were summoned to the scene, and they discovered that Mark had been shot several times. Shell casings were scattered inside and outside the vehicle, and it appeared that the shots were likely fired into Mark at close range from the vehicle's passenger side while he was sitting in the driver's seat. In fact, there were so many shell casings that the shooter likely had to reload their gun at least twice. A paper bag filled with .38 caliber bullets was also found on the right front floorboard. Even though Mark's car keys and some of his jewelry were missing, his wallet had been left behind and there was still money inside, so robbery did not appear to be the motive for the crime. But since Mark had a reputation for being a very nice guy with no known enemies, nobody who knew him could figure out what the motive might be and why anyone would be compelled to shoot him so many times. It turned out that on the same morning Mark's body was discovered, his wife Judy had reported him missing because he failed to return home the previous evening. When investigators questioned Judy, she claimed that around 6:30 p.m. on April the 6th, she and Mark had gone out to dinner at a local restaurant with a female friend. They then went to a liquor store to purchase some whiskey, but while Mark wanted to go out to a bar to play some pool, Judy was not feeling well, so Mark agreed to drop her off at home, and their female friend said that she would keep Judy company while Mark was out. They both claimed that they last saw Mark at around 8 o'clock before he drove away, but Judy said she could not think of any reason why Mark would have gone to Lookout Mountain. Judy's friend corroborated her story, telling police that they watched television together at Judy's house until around midnight. Since Mark did not return home, the friend decided to stay over by sleeping on the couch. However, there seemed to be a discrepancy in the timeline, as some witnesses who went to a wedding rehearsal at the Mother Cabrini Shrine on the evening of April the 6th claimed that they drove towards the entrance at around 8 p.m. and saw Mark's 1973 Buick already parked there by the side of the road. When the wedding rehearsal ended around 2 hours later, and these same witnesses drove past that spot again, they said the Buick was still parked there. In an attempt to track down the murder weapon, investigators ran a check on all 38 caliber guns which had recently been purchased in the Denver area and discovered that Judy had purchased a 38 from a Denver pawn shop on April the 3rd, only 3 days before Mark was killed. Judy never disclosed this information during her original questioning, but claimed she had forgotten about it, and now said that Mark had asked her to purchase the gun on his behalf, and he was going to give it to an underage friend of his who was unable to buy the gun on their own. Mark said he didn't have time to purchase the 38 himself, so after Judy bought it, she said she gave the gun to Mark and never saw it again. Judy said she was alone when she frequented the pawn shop, but when investigators questioned the manager, they showed him a photo of Mark and Judy. While the manager recognized Judy, he also said that she had a male companion with her who was definitely not Mark, but rather a long-haired guy who resembled a biker. According to the manager, when Judy was picking up the gun, she called this man over to her to ask his opinion about it. The manager also said that Judy purchased ammunition, another detail which she never mentioned to police, and it also seemed odd that she would be buying ammo to begin with, since the gun was supposedly going to be passed along to one of Mark's friends. Judy denied that she had been with a man in the pawn shop, but it turned out there was another discrepancy in her story. As you recall, she claimed that after she left the restaurant with Mark and her friend on the night of the murder, they had stopped at a liquor store to purchase whiskey before Mark dropped them off at home. Investigators questioned the employee who worked at the liquor store that night, and even though she knew both Mark and Judy personally, she maintained that she never saw them there on April the 6th. But curiously enough, the employee did recall seeing Judy at the liquor store a few days after Mark's murder, but she was accompanied by an unidentified man who had long hair and resembled a biker, and seemed to match the description of the man seen with Judy at the pawn shop. To make things even stranger, a six-pack of beer was found in Mark's car at the murder scene, alongside a receipt which showed that it was purchased at a completely different liquor store on the evening of April the 6th. It also turned out that Judy's fingerprints were on one of the bottles, making it unlikely that Mark could have bought this beer after he dropped Judy off at home. In spite of the ever-mounting evidence which seemed to indicate that Judy was lying, her female friend continued to back up her alibi by claiming they were together during the time period Mark was killed. However, this friend raised some eyebrows by permanently moving into Judy's residence the day after the murder, and a couple of acquaintances would tell investigators that Judy and this woman were more than friends and likely involved in a relationship. It also turned out that 2 months prior to his death, Mark had taken out a life insurance policy on himself for $100,000 and named Judy as the beneficiary. Since Judy had become a suspect in Mark's murder, the insurance company was reluctant to pay out the money to her, but the dispute between the two parties was eventually settled out of court. This case would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in January of 1990, and the show revealed that Judy and her female companion were still living together at that point and had since bought a new house. But during her interview on the show, Judy continued to maintain that they were nothing more than close friends. Even though investigators believed there was a compelling circumstantial case against Judy, there was no direct evidence placing her at the murder scene, which is why no charges were ever filed. Judy continued to maintain her innocence, and even claimed that she took a lie detector test at her own expense, and the results supported her story. Whatever the case, there have been no new developments in the investigation these past few decades, so Mark Rosinger's murder continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So I mentioned in the intro that Unsolved Mysteries featured quite a few cases in which a victim went missing or was murdered and their spouse was suspected of being responsible. More often than not, the victim was female and the suspected spouse was male, but the cases of Jim Rice and Mark Rosinger were the show's rare examples of stories where a male victim was believed to have been murdered by his wife. I'll state right up front that you're not going to find too many Unsolved Mysteries fans who believe that Astarte Davis Rice and Judy Grosinger are innocent, and some of them would even argue that the evidence might have been strong enough to charge both of them with murder. Well, Astarte has at least suffered some sort of consequences for actions, as she was indicted on a number of fraud charges relating to the handling of her husband's estate and spent time in prison, but without Jim's body or any direct evidence of foul play, you can understand why the authorities were reluctant to indict her for murder. Mark Rosinger's murder is an entirely different matter, since he was found shot several times, and there was compelling circumstantial evidence to suggest that Judy was involved in the crime, or at the very least, knew more than she was telling. Yet it appears that investigators just did not think that the evidence was strong enough to make an arrest, bring her to trial, and secure a conviction. Now, it was common practice for many of the suspected spouses in these unsolved mysteries cases to agree to be interviewed on the show so they could make an attempt to publicly proclaim their innocence, but more often than not, they did not come across well and only made viewers become even more suspicious of them. Astarte was not interviewed, and this was likely due to the fact that she was sitting in jail and awaiting trial on other charges at the time the Unsolved Mysteries segment was filmed, so I'm sure her attorney advised her not to say anything. By contrast, Judy did agree to do an on-camera interview on the show, and, well, she did not come across too flatteringly. One of my biggest pet peeves in the true crime world is when victims' spouses or family members are automatically assumed to be guilty because they don't appear to be emotional enough during interviews, as different people will process grief in different ways. All that being said, Judy's flat, monotone delivery on Unsolved Mysteries really gives the impression that there's something off about her. To be fair, she does speak glowingly of her deceased husband and talks about what a nice guy Mark was. I would be willing to overlook Judy's lack of emotion if she had been able to provide satisfactory explanations for the discrepancies in her story and some of the incriminating evidence against her, but she doesn't, and most viewers do not come away with the impression that she is being falsely accused. I think what complicates things and may have prevented the authorities from filing murder charges is that there may have been up to 3 people involved in each of these crimes. Of course, it's been suspected that Astarte's son Noble was complicit in Jim's disappearance and likely murder, and at the very least, helped her commit fraud in order to seize control of his estate. But if you go to the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum I'm always referencing, you'll find a thread about this case containing some interesting comments from a poster under the username Real Rice. I have a feeling that this person may have been related to Jim or had some sort of personal connection to him, and they allege that his death was a murder-for-hire plot, which involved another man from St. Croix. I won't repeat this person's name, since he's never been mentioned by law enforcement or any media outlets, but the allegations are that Astarte hired him to kill Jim and use power of attorney to sign over Jim's fishing boat to this man as payment for the hit. And apparently, a few months later, the boat was seized by United States Customs agents in Tortola, which is part of the British Virgin Islands, because this hitman had been using it for drug smuggling. In the Grosinger case, it's been suspected that Judy's female friend was complicit in Mark's murder and helped provide her with a false alibi, and there's also the unidentified biker guy who was seen with Judy when she purchased a gun. So even though there's compelling evidence that both Astarte and Judy orchestrated some sort of murder plot, we can't be 100% certain that either of them personally killed their spouses, which could cause some complications with filing murder charges. Anyway, I'll start off by talking about Jim's case, because even though Judy has stayed free these past 4 decades, Astarte has spent a considerable amount of time behind bars and is clearly an habitual criminal. I previously mentioned that she was originally born as Esther Bell White before she changed her name to Astarte, and I can kind of understand why, since it sounds like she did not have the happiest childhood. Astarte grew up in a poor farming family in Monterey County, California, and according to an interview I saw with Astarte's sister, she ran away from home at the age of 13 because there was abuse in her household. Astarte's first brush with the law actually occurred 1 year before she met Jim, as in 1969, Astarte worked as a bookkeeper for the Kent Manufacturing Company in San Rafael, but was arrested on suspicion of having embezzled $1,955 from them. She received a sentence in which she would have to spend 5 separate weekends in jail and also got 2 years probation and was ordered to pay restitution to her former employer. It sounds like Astarte soon found herself another bookkeeping job working for Jim, though it's unclear if he ever found out about her previous arrest. This would become a recurring theme because in the ensuing decades, there would be two separate occasions in which she managed to get a bookkeeping job under a false identity while she was on the run as a wanted fugitive. In fact, the whole reason she was captured in 1991 is because she was arrested for embezzling from her employer, which is an incredibly stupid thing to do when you're hiding from the authorities. When Astarte escaped from prison years later, she was once again discovered to be working as a bookkeeper, and it seemed to take her new employer by complete surprise that she was a wanted criminal, as he had nothing but good things to say about her job performance. I get the impression that Astarte must have had a very charming personality in order to fool so many people like that, and this would probably explain why Jim kept agreeing to reconcile with her, even after she served time in prison for bankruptcy fraud and committed insurance fraud by blowing up his boat. Now, if you do a search of Astarte Davis Rice's name online, you'll find that she has filed a number of legal appeals and lawsuits over the years, most of them while she was behind bars, and they are virtually all frivolous. Jim's family did win a civil lawsuit against Astarte and Noble, but they never received any money, and Astarte's response was to constantly file countersuits. As a result, the family has pretty much spent Jim's entire estate fighting her in court, and nearly been driven to financial ruin. It really does appear that she has some sort of narcissistic personality disorder, and the fact that she escaped from prison in 1998 might point to that. I mean, it's not like she was serving a life sentence, as she had received 15 years, and nearly served half of that before her escape. She was also incarcerated in a minimum security facility, which wouldn't exactly have been filled with violent criminals, so why not just hold on for a few more years and do the rest of your time before you're released? Given the massive amount of fraud that Astarte committed while trying to seize control of Jim's estate, it is virtually impossible to imagine her being innocent of any involvement in his disappearance. Nonetheless, Astarte did try to push forward a cover story about Jim leaving her to sail to Australia with another woman, but no evidence was ever found to suggest there's any truth to that. It seems pretty obvious that the letter which Kathy supposedly received from her father was typed up by Astarte, and if Jim really was alive, why wouldn't he have attempted to contact Kathy again? They show the letter on screen during the Unsolved Mysteries segment, and this section always stood out to me. Quote, "Kathy, I did not come to California in August as I thought I might, because I could tell by the tone of your voice that you really didn't want me to," end quote. But that statement really doesn't make any sense, since Jim's primary purpose for traveling to California was not to visit Kathy, but to undergo shoulder surgery. If his shoulder was bothering him, why wouldn't he get the surgery and deal with it before taking off to Australia and starting a new life? As far as I can tell, the letter didn't make any mention of Astarte seizing control of his estate and selling off his personal items after he left. Considering that Jim was a self-made man who earned his entire fortune on his own, you would think he would be a bit more invested in the fact that his former spouse was taking control of his finances without any sort of formal separation agreement. There's also the fact that Astarte changed her story about Jim sailing off to Australia and then claimed that he flew to Miami. I think she may have done this because she was caught in a lie. As you recall, a plane ticket from St. Croix to Miami was purchased under Jim's name on July the 28th, 1986, but his signature was likely forged on the customs declaration form, and it's suspected that the ticket was actually used by Noble, who boarded the flight alongside his girlfriend and his mother. If Jim purchased the ticket himself prior to his disappearance, then I can only assume that he was planning to fly to Miami in order to catch a connecting flight, since a direct flight from St. Croix to San Francisco would be quite lengthy. Apparently, the reason that Astarte and Noble took this flight is because they needed to make a trip to the Guardian Savings Bank in Houston, Texas, in order to fraudulently transfer two $100,000 certificates of deposit from Jim's account into an account that was held by a corporation owned by Astarte and her sons. I think Astarte may have realized that the presence of this plane ticket under Jim's name contradicted her account of him sailing to Australia, which is why she changed her story in order to account for it. One reason I decided to cover this case, alongside another cold case on this episode, is that, well, there really isn't too much to break down and analyze here. I'd like to come up with any conceivable alternate scenarios which don't involve a Stardate killing Jim or having him killed, but that's pretty much impossible. But of course, the biggest obstacle against proving foul play is that Jim was living on an island next to the Caribbean Sea when he disappeared, so there's no shortage of places to dispose of his body, and there's a good chance he wound up at the bottom of the sea. And since a considerable amount of time passed before a proper investigation was launched, the responsible parties would have had ample time to get rid of any evidence. However, I would still be curious to know how these events would have played out. The last time Jim was confirmed to be alive was when he phoned his daughter on July the 20th, 1986, but by the morning of the 21st, Astarte was already presenting documents to a notary in order to take control of Jim's estate. This is why everyone suspects that Jim was killed during this window of about 12 hours. But could Jim's death have been a crime of passion, or was it premeditated and planned in advance? Well, a lot of doctoring had to be done on this paperwork, such as when Astarte cut and pasted her own name on the power of attorney document that Jim had once drawn up for Kathy. If Jim's murder was unplanned, I'm not sure Astarte would have had the wherewithal to have all these documents prepared to seize his estate in such a short amount of time. And if the rumors are true that Astarte hired another man to kill Jim, then this crime was definitely planned well in advance. But of course, the big question is, why did Astarte decide to murder Jim at that particular point in time? After all, they had been together since 1970, and even after Astarte served time in prison, he was willing to take her back and relocate to St. Croix in order to build their dream house, which seemed like a long-term commitment for the couple to enjoy their golden years. I don't know if Jim ever gave off any indication that he wanted to end things with Astarte, but he did have a phone conversation with his daughter, in which he said that he felt something might be going on with Astarte, so Kathy should come looking for him if he ever disappeared. So that could be a sign that Jim was planning to end the relationship, or he already suspected that Astarte was planning to get rid of him. It's possible that since Astarte now had her dream house, and Jim was retired and no longer generating any income, she decided he had outlived his usefulness and got rid of him. Perhaps she feared that when Jim visited Kathy in California, he might share some incriminating information with her, which is why Astarte had to do this before he left on his trip. We know that Astarte was eventually released from prison for her other crimes, and I already mentioned that I've never found any confirmation that she has passed away, so she could still be alive at the time of this recording at the age of 91. That obviously means that time is running out to build a case against her for Jim's murder, but even if she does pass away without facing justice, Noble is at least still alive and can continue to be investigated as a potential suspect even after his mother is gone. If Jim is at the bottom of the Caribbean Sea, I'm not sure it will be possible to recover his remains, but it would be nice if Jim's surviving family members could finally receive conclusive answers about what happened to him. So now let's move on to the Mark Rosinger murder, as the investigators on that case obviously can't use lack of a body as a reason not to file charges. What's particularly frustrating is that the Unsolved Mystery segment is no longer available for viewing on their official FilmRise channel on Amazon Prime or YouTube. The official statement has always been that a number of the show's older segments could not be released on the channel for quote-unquote legal reasons, which is fair enough, but it always baffles me why they are unable to release their segments about cases which are still unsolved today and could use additional exposure. I should also mention that other than Unsolved Mysteries, there is very little additional information available about this case online, other than some brief profile pages on websites such as the Colorado Bureau of Investigation Cold Case Files. So I have to wonder if there might be something about the presentation of the case by Unsolved Mysteries which has prevented them from being able to show it anymore. While the segment really makes Judy Grosinger look guilty as sin, I do have to acknowledge that it contains an interview with Mark's brother, Kenneth Grosinger, who seems a bit skeptical that Judy was involved in the murder and says, quote-unquote, "I don't think Judy would do that kind of thing." It's also worth mentioning that if you go to the Find a Grave website, you'll find a page for Mark, who is buried at the Dirunda Center Trinity Lutheran Cemetery in Elizabeth, Illinois, the state where he was originally born. But what's particularly interesting is that Mark is buried alongside his mother, Marita Grossinger, and father, Laverl Grossinger, who actually died less than 8 months after Mark did. There is a photo of the headstone at their cemetery plot, which has all three of their names on it, but strangely, Judy's name and her birth year are on the headstone as well. Her year of death has been left blank, so the implication seems to be that Judy will be buried there after she passes away. I have no idea if the Grossinger family believes that Judy was responsible for Mark's murder, but if they do, I cannot imagine they would allow her to be buried in the family plot alongside the man she killed. So as hard as this may be to imagine, could there be something missing from the story which casts suspicion away from Judy? Well, the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum has a lengthy thread about this case, containing a few comments from posters who appear to have some inside knowledge. One of them was a poster under the username JKT589, who claims that their mother was one of Judy's ex-girlfriends, and also said that Judy and Mark had a young son, though this detail was not mentioned on Unsolved Mysteries. There's also a poster in that thread under the username Zier, who confirmed that the couple did have a son, but they were also very defensive about proclaiming Judy's innocence and alleged that Unsolved Mysteries got a lot of the facts wrong and their presentation was pure sensationalism. But this poster also displayed some trollish behavior during their time on the board, which has led to speculation that Zier may have been Judy herself. Now, if you were to look up Judy on social media several years ago, you would have easily found photographs of her with a female spouse, who was apparently the same female friend who had been hanging out with Judy and Mark on the night of his death. I can't find much online presence for Judy today, so it's possible she's since scrubbed her social media accounts, but if you look hard enough, you can find the name of her female friend, though I'm not going to repeat it here, since she's never been publicly named by law enforcement or the media. Since their segment was produced back in 1990, it is a bit amusing to see Unsolved Mysteries tread lightly when discussing the relationship between Judy and her friend, though one of the detectives who was interviewed says he heard from people that Judy and this woman were, quote-unquote, more than friends. So yes, it now seems obvious that they were involved in a lesbian relationship, which on its own is no big deal. But because this woman technically functioned as Judy's alibi witness and moved in with her immediately after her husband was killed, knowing the full details about their relationship does make you question the woman's credibility and wonder how much knowledge or involvement she may have had in the murder. Even before Judy became a potential suspect, investigators were surprised by the sheer overkill involved in Mark's murder, as whoever pulled the trigger had to reload their gun at least twice in order to fire all those shots into him. Kenneth Grossinger even said that when he first heard the details of the shooting, he thought it might have been some sort of gang thing, but the issue is that Mark's car was parked in a pretty remote spot, so what are the odds that a random person would happen to come by and fire all those shots into him? Since Mark's wallet was left behind, robbery was certainly not the motive, but regardless of who killed him, no one has any idea why Mark would have traveled to this spot to begin with. Now, it was probably a lucky break for investigators that some witnesses were driving through this area for a wedding rehearsal on the night of Mark's death and happened to see his car parked there at both 8 and 10 p.m. This seemed to contradict Judy's story that Mark dropped her off at home at 8 o'clock, and it was the first discrepancy which made them realize that she wasn't telling the complete truth. There's a good chance that Mark had already been shot before those witnesses drove past his car at 8 o'clock, but given that it was nighttime and it does not appear that the area was well lit, I can understand them not noticing that shattered driver's side window and why the crime wasn't reported to police until the following morning. The murder has been described as resembling a crime of passion, so theoretically, if Judy was the trigger person, she could have gotten into an argument with Mark up there and lost her temper so badly that she went into a rage and pulled out her gun to fire several bullets into him. However, since Judy was seen buying a .38 caliber gun alongside an unidentified man 3 days before Mark was killed, that really points to the crime being planned and premeditated, particularly when you consider the insurance policy which was taken out on Mark's life just 2 months earlier. Now, since the murder weapon was never found, we can't say with 100% certainty that it was the same gun used to shoot Mark, but even if you consider the possibility that it was just a coincidence, that Judy purchased a completely different .38 and forgot to tell the police about it, I find it very troubling that she could not produce the gun after the murder. Her story was that Mark told her to purchase the gun on behalf of someone else, and after she gave it to Mark, she never saw it again. But I find it very odd that Judy never even learned the name of the person who was supposed to receive this gun. If Judy was telling the truth, that individual could have been questioned by police and handed over the .38, so they could rule out the possibility that it was the same gun used in the murder. And of course, we cannot overlook the discrepancy of the pawn shop manager claiming that he saw Judy speak to an unidentified biker guy while purchasing the gun, even though Judy maintained that she bought the gun while she was alone. Now, in online discussions about this case, I've seen the theory push forward that perhaps this biker was actually Judy's female friend and the manager mistook her for a man, but while I can't say with 100% certainty that this detail is accurate, the Unsolved Mysteries reenactment of the scene depicts the biker as having a beard. Sure, I suppose Judy's friend could have put on a fake beard to disguise herself if she didn't want to be seen in the pawn shop, but the issue is that Judy was seen alongside this same biker at a liquor store a few days after Mark's murder. I could see the female friend going to the trouble of disguising herself when purchasing the murder weapon, but why do that for a routine trip to the liquor store in her hometown? Also, if the female friend had a tendency to dress up like a biker whenever she went out in public, I have a feeling this would have been mentioned by the authorities. No, I do tend to believe that this biker was some other male acquaintance of Judy's, and she may have enlisted his help for her murder plot, but who was this guy, and how did Judy know him? The fact that Judy wanted to get his feedback when purchasing the .38 suggests that he may have been the one who actually pulled the trigger and shot Mark. On the surface, you could assume this was a murder for hire, where the biker would kill Mark while Judy was at home watching TV with her friend, providing her with an alibi. However, the problem with this scenario is that we're still missing some pieces of the puzzle of how Mark made it from point A to point B. If Judy was telling the truth, and Mark dropped her and her friend off at home, why would he travel up to Lookout Mountain and park near the Mother Cabrini Shrine? How did the shooter even know Mark would go there? Well, the other discrepancy in Judy's story is that Mark purchased some whiskey at a liquor store on the way home from dinner at the restaurant, but the employee working there that night did not recall seeing Mark or Judy. A six-pack of beer was also found inside Mark's vehicle, which had been purchased from a different liquor store that same evening, and Judy's fingerprints were on one of the bottles. This discrepancy always baffles me, as I don't know what Judy would have had to gain by lying about Mark purchasing the whiskey. If she and Mark went to a different liquor store to purchase beer instead, why not just say so? Judy could still say that Mark dropped her off at home and drove off with the beer still inside the car, and it wouldn't look as suspicious. But I guess this could be easily explained by the fact that Judy was not a master criminal and had never orchestrated a murder before, so she simply made some stupid mistakes. And of course, the presence of Judy's fingerprints on the beer bottle indicates that Mark could not have purchased it on his own after dropping off Judy at home. I think it's possible that after they finished dinner, Mark purchased the beer and made plans with Judy and her friend to go somewhere. Perhaps Judy suggested Lookout Mountain because there is a pretty nice view up there, so she might have said it would be a good place to chill out and drink some beers. But in actuality, Judy picked this spot because she knew it was an isolated location and an ideal place to ambush and kill Mark. I have to assume that Mark, Judy, and their friend all went out to dinner in the same car, so unless Mark dropped the friend off beforehand, I have a feeling that she was present when the murder took place and likely had advanced knowledge of what was going to happen since she was willing to provide Judy with an alibi. It sounds like the glass on the driver's side window went outward when it was shattered, indicating that the killer shot Mark while sitting in the passenger seat. This suggests that the shooter was someone Mark knew, but if it wasn't Judy or the friend, the biker could have shown up and climbed into the passenger seat while holding Mark at gunpoint and then killed him. Since the large number of shots gives off the impression that the crime was some sort of rage killing by an individual with a major hatred towards Mark, you might wonder why this random biker would do that. But the alternate explanation is that this guy had never committed a murder before and had no idea what he was doing and just got carried away, which is why he reloaded the gun multiple times to fire off all these shots. In spite of what pop culture might tell you, most murder-for-hire plots don't involve skilled assassins or contract killers, so if Judy needed to find someone who would kill her husband, I'm sure she couldn't be picky about who she selected. Another sign that this was a sloppy murder is that a paper bag containing 38 caliber bullets was found on the car's floorboard, as the killer likely brought it with them, but mistakenly left it behind. I'm assuming they couldn't trace the specific ammunition to the pawn shop, because if it could be proven that Judy had purchased it, I'm sure she already would have been arrested. If Judy was present when the murder took place, you might be wondering why she bothered to involve a third party. But the simple explanation is that if Judy was driven to Lookout Mountain in Mark's Buick, she would have needed a ride home, so either the biker or the friend was there to provide it. Another bizarre detail about the crime is that Mark's car keys were never found, but perhaps the simple explanation for that is that the same key ring contained his house keys, and Judy needed them to get back into their house. Afterward, she disposed of Mark's car keys and the murder weapon. I have no idea who this biker may have been, but the fact that Judy was seen with him in a liquor store in the days following the murder suggests that they may have already been acquainted and had a personal history, and he was not just some stranger passing through town. I also don't know if investigators have ever had suspicions about who the biker might be, but I think his very existence could create reasonable doubt if Judy was ever charged with murder and put on trial. While there is a compelling circumstantial case against Judy, her defense team could claim that she bought the gun for the biker, but had no idea he was going to use it to shoot her husband a few days later. There is no hard evidence placing Judy at the murder scene, so unless this biker can be tracked down or found, or Judy's female friend is willing to share the full truth about what happened, I think the authorities will always be reluctant to file charges. Next year will mark the 40th anniversary of Mark's murder, and it is sad that the responsible party or parties are continuing to get away with it. So if you happen to have any information about the murder of Mark Rosinger or the disappearance of Jim Rice, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives. This past month, I released an episode titled The Lost Heirs of Unsolved Mysteries, which explores a couple of cases from the show about mysterious individuals who left a substantial amount of money behind when they passed away, and the authorities were attempting to track down any rightful heirs who were entitled to inherit the decedent's estate. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spinoff podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the unexplained 1995 death of Devin Williams. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 50 of those commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Gina O, Teresa R, Stacy C, Tim B, Kitty D, and Jamie B. Thank you so much for your support. Anyway, in just over 2 weeks, The Trail Went Cold will be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, which is being held from September the 22nd to the 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code, which can be used to get a 10% discount on tickets, so in order to do so, please visit crimecon.com and use the special promo code COOL23. That's COOL23. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit and the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, which has a number of interesting threads about both these featured cases. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the ear music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a great week and join us next Wednesday for an all-new episode of The Trail Went Cold.